Millions of people tune in to watch the Harris-Trump presidential debate. We have highlights, analysis, ramifications of the head-to-head matchup, all from a Catholic perspective. EWTN News is on the ground, traveling with Pope Francis as he wraps up his apostolic visit to Southeast Asia. Observations from our correspondent, who watched as massive crowds embraced the pontiff and his message of goodwill. Thousands gather in South America for the International Eucharistic Congress, a report from our broadcast team in Ecuador. And we share portions of the EWTN family celebration as we welcome you, the viewer, to continue the fellowship started by our beloved Mother Angelica. EWTN News in Depth starts now.
Kamala Harris, let's have a good debate.
Nice to see you. Have fun.
Thank you.
An unexpected handshake to start a consequential presidential debate, watched by more than 67 million people across America. You've heard debate analysis already on other news sources. Today, a view of the debate from a Catholic perspective. Welcome to EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. Despite their years at the forefront of our national politics, former President Donald Trump and Vice President Kamala Harris had never met before Tuesday. But in the intense spotlight of this week's debate, their exchanges were sharp and personal. You've surely already heard the commentary. Now, through a Catholic lens, our coverage begins with reporter Mark Irons.
She's destroying this country.
It is important that we move forward, that we turn the page on this same old tired rhetoric.
A contentious presidential debate between former President Donald Trump and Vice President Kamala Harris began with a back and forth about the economy.
Everybody knows what I'm going to do, cut taxes very substantially and create a great economy like I did before.
His plan is to do what he has done before, which is to provide a tax cut for billionaires and big corporations, which will result in $5 trillion to America's deficit.
Important issues to Catholics came up in the debate. A recent EWTN News and Real Clear Opinion Research poll shows the majority of voters who identify as Catholic, 51%, consider the economy to be the most important issue in deciding their vote this November. The next most important issue at 13% was border security and immigration. In the debate, Trump criticized the Biden-Harris administration for failing to control the southern border.
They allowed terrorists. They allowed common street criminals. They allowed people to come in, drug dealers, to come into our country, and they're now in the United States.
Meanwhile, Harris blamed Trump when Congress failed to pass an immigration bill earlier this year that she said would have prosecuted transnational criminal organizations.
But you know what happened to that bill? Donald Trump got on the phone, called up some folks in Congress and said, kill the bill. And you know why? Because he'd prefer to run on a problem instead of fixing a problem.
According to the EWTN poll, the third most important issue for Catholic-identifying voters was abortion at 10%. Catholic Church teaching states human life must be respected and protected absolutely from the moment of conception. And in their document, Forming Consciences for Faithful Citizenship, calling for political responsibility among Catholic Americans, U.S. bishops write, the threat of abortion remains our preeminent priority because it directly attacks our most vulnerable and voiceless brothers and sisters. On the debate stage, Harris voiced clear support for abortion and said this about her opponent.
If Donald Trump were to be reelected, he will sign a national abortion ban.
It's a lie. I'm not signing a ban, and there's no reason to sign a ban because we've gotten what everybody wanted.
Trump wouldn't say if he'd veto an abortion ban if Congress had the votes to pass one. But he did tout his appointment of Supreme Court justices who overturned Roe v. Wade, removing a so-called right to abortion at the federal level in 2022, moving abortion law from the federal to state level.
And now states are voting on it.
Trump expressed support for states making their own laws about abortion while at the same time concern about late-term abortions under a Harris administration.
You should ask, will she allow abortion in the 8th month, 9th month, 7th month?
Come on.
Okay, would you do that? Why don't you ask her that question?
Why don't you answer
That's the
question?
Problem.
Would you
because
veto?
Under Roe v. Wade,
answer the question.
You
would
could,
you veto?
You could do abortions in the 7th month, the 8th month, the 9th month.
Not true. Would you support any restrictions on a woman's right to an abortion?
I absolutely support reinstating the protections of Roe v. Wade. And I pledge to you, when Congress passes a bill to put back in place the protections of Roe v. Wade, as President of the United States, I will proudly sign it into law.
Harris also expressed concerns about women being denied access to IVF. But IVF is contrary to Catholic Church teaching because it separates the marital act from procreation. Trump voiced support for it.
I have been a leader on IVF.
Regarding protection for unborn children, we asked James Patterson, a Catholic and political science professor at Ave Maria University, to share his thoughts on Harris and Trump.
Trump has essentially ended up where the Democrats were in the 90s. This is the days of the Clinton safe, legal, and rare abortion position. That's essentially Trump's. Whereas, you know, you see with the Democratic Party a very strong emphasis on access to abortion as a positive right. Women are thought to be less free if they have no access.
Issues abroad were also debated by the presidential hopefuls this week. Trump claimed under his watch, wars wouldn't be happening in Ukraine and the Middle East.
If I were president, it would have never started.
But Harris said Trump fails to lead on the international stage.
So many military leaders who you have worked with have told me you are a disgrace.
The U.S. troop withdrawal from Afghanistan in 2021 was debated as well.
Four presidents said they would, and Joe Biden did.
These people did the worst withdrawal and, in my opinion, the most embarrassing moment in the history of our country.
In November, Americans will decide who will be their next president. Patterson shares a final thought for Catholic voters.
It should probably do away with a lot of the messianic sort of beliefs we have about presidents. The president is just one of the constitutional officers, and we should probably just leave it at that level, right? Just a man or a woman in office. And if you want miracles, look to our Lord.
Mark Irons, EWTN News in depth.
Whether or not there will be another debate between Harris and Trump looks doubtful. After Tuesday's debate, the Harris campaign immediately proposed another one in October. But on social media, Trump announced there was no need for another matchup. A debate for vice presidential candidates J.D. Vance and Tim Walz is on the books for Tuesday, October 1st. Less than 12 hours after their debate, the vice president and former president were shaking hands on Wednesday at New York's 9/11 commemoration ceremony. They both attended the event at Ground Zero, as did President Joe Biden and J.D. Vance. 23 years ago, in 2001, hijacked planes crashed into the two towers of the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, and a field in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, killing nearly 3,000 people. Every 4 years, the date falls in the thick of the presidential election season. But regardless of the campaign calendar, organizers of anniversary ceremonies have long taken pains to keep the focus on the 9/11 victims. After their attendance at the New York Memorial, President Biden and Vice President Harris traveled on to Shanksville and then to the Pentagon for ceremonies there. Pundits continued dissecting the debate between Harris and Trump through the week. Joining us now to analyze the debate from a Catholic perspective is moral theologian Charles Camosi, professor of medical humanities at the Creighton University School of Medicine. Charlie, it's great to see you. And earlier this week, you had a piece published in The Atlantic titled "Pro-Life Voters Are Politically Homeless." You said pro-lifers don't fit into any major party. So after watching the debate this week, Charlie, is that still your stance?
I think it has to be. I mean, what we have before us, at least with the two major candidates, and there are other people we could consider, but the two major candidates are, one is pro-abortion, right? Until birth and sometimes after birth. The other is pro-choice, with slightly less objectionable views. But I've spent, let's just say, a lot of decades in the pro-life movement, and we've spent a lot of time working for pro-life candidates to try to get pro-life candidates into the places where we could support them. And one of the things I argue in the Atlantic piece is what this unfortunate situation actually gives us is a chance to maybe get back to our roots, to say maybe the most important thing isn't the next election cycle or the next 2 or 3 years, but those foundational values of nonviolence, care for the most vulnerable, and giving a voice to the voiceless.
Abortion has definitely been a big topic this election cycle and was a big topic at the debate. There's been a lot of buzz about the fact-checking that the ABC moderators did throughout the debate. Let's take a listen to this comment from former President Donald Trump on abortion and how ABC moderator Lindsay Davis responded.
Her vice presidential pick says abortion in the ninth month is absolutely fine. He also says execution after birth, it's execution, no longer abortion, because the baby is born, is okay. And that's not okay with me.
There is no state in this country where it is legal to kill a baby after it's born.
Charlie, you study abortion laws closely. Is that an accurate fact check?
Let me steel man her argument as best I could. If what she means by that is there's no possible place in a state where you can do an active killing, you know, with giving the child poison or with a sharp instrument or something, then she's right about that. But she's totally wrong if by what we're talking about, that's of course what we're talking about, is medical neglect, aiming at death by omission after abortion or after, this is something that hasn't been talked about as much, Catherine, I think it should be. What often happens is in these contexts is there's a disabled child prenatally, and the medical team puts significant pressure on parents to have an abortion. Parents tell me stories about this all the time. And often the parents refuse, right? And sometimes the medical team will say, well, we could even make a decision about this after birth, right? They could. What they're saying is we can medically neglect the child after birth until they die by omission. This happens, unfortunately, regularly. And so if what the fact checker is saying is that doesn't happen, she's unfortunately incorrect about that.
And we heard former President Trump mention the Democratic vice president, Governor Tim Walz in Minnesota. What do we know about his stance on that in the state that he governs?
I mean, one of the reasons why we know this happens is because Tim Walz and company specifically changed the laws in Minnesota, which would have required medical teams to care for babies in those particular situations, newborn babies in those particular situations. It made it illegal to engage in medical neglect, aiming at the death of children in those circumstances. They changed the laws specifically to allow medical neglect in those situations, which is the extension of abortion. Again, often this comes about because of a failed abortion or because abortion was pushed and maybe you thought we could, well, do the same kind of thing after birth. Tim Walz in Minnesota changed the laws, let's be absolutely clear about this, to allow that kind of medical neglect to happen.
Thank you for your clarification on that. Something that's unique in this cycle is that both major parties are supporting the use of in vitro fertilization or IVF. As a theologian, can you explain why that is problematic for Catholic voters?
Yeah, I think the first thing to say about this is we can always start with what Pope Francis says as being a field hospital, right? So there's tremendous pain out there, and you and I both know about this, with regard to infertility and people trying to get pregnant. And this is one answer. IVF is not the right answer, but that's one answer to some people experiencing this pain. So let's acknowledge that right up front. This is very personal for many people. What happens in IVF, as most of your viewers know, is that these embryos that are created often don't get, quote unquote, used in the process. And so either get discarded as trash. This is another example of throwaway culture. We were just talking about medical neglect as throwaway culture. This is throwaway culture again. Or they get used and killed via embryonic research. Or they get indefinitely frozen, essentially a kind of captivity. And this is classic throwaway culture. So if we're going to participate in this as a response to the very real pain of infertility, this is not the right kind of response. We need to find alternatives that don't participate so dramatically in throwaway culture.
Charlie, turning to the topic of the economy, though it's still related to the pro-life issue, Vice President Kamala Harris boasted about her plan to extend a $6,000 child tax credit for families. And I should note, Republican vice presidential candidate J.D. Vance has campaigned on a $5,000 tax credit. How significant for families are these tax credit proposals? And are you surprised it seems both parties are in agreement on this?
A little bit, though. I think one good thing that has come from Trump's election back in 2016 is the Republican Party has been shifted pretty dramatically on these questions. The party that existed before him was a libertarian party, right? One that didn't really talk about these kinds of things as easily. J.D. Vance represents something quite different, a party that would support families, that would really be aggressive in supporting children this way. And so that's all to the good. And that's a big part, I think, that we can agree on across. We don't hear a lot about agreement across abortion difference these days. There's a lot more money to be made, pitting people against each other. But one thing that we can agree on, isn't it? These kinds of supports for families to make it easier for women and families to choose life. This is deep, profound common ground that we should be seeking.
Mm. Charlie, with our final minute remaining together, was there anything else that stood out to you from the debate you think is significant? And based on this debate, what's your pulse of the nation's political health right now?
Well, this kind of gets back to the original point I was making in The Atlantic. I think it's good for pro-lifers and for Catholics to kind of step back and take a look at the horror show that that debate was. I mean, we have really two warring political and ideological ecosystems that couldn't care less, actually, about finding the kind of common ground I was discussing before. But if we can get back to our first principles and say that we are in but not of the world, that Christ's kingdom is not of this world, that we're to witness to that kingdom coming later in its fullness, we can, I think, step outside of what we saw in that debate and be pro-life Catholics in a way that can be unifiers, right? Bridge builders, stepping outside of that morass. And I think the time, could have asked for a better time for something like that than right now.
That's a great reminder. We need to keep our eyes on Christ throughout this campaign season. Charlie Camosi, so grateful for your perspective. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Catherine.
We are just getting started on this edition of EWTN News in Depth. Stay right there. Images and analysis from the Pope's most ambitious journey yet. More than 20,000 miles, hundreds of thousands of worshipers, and an endless stream of prayers as the pontiff touches the lives of the faithful in Southeast Asia, focusing on the real presence of Christ at the International Eucharistic Congress. Our broadcast team brings us the highlights. And later, celebrating Mother Angelica's vision of building a family with you, our viewers. Details of this year's EWTN Family Celebration. Hundreds of young people cheering for Pope Francis in East Timor. It was one of his last stops in the small Catholic nation before heading to Singapore, his fourth and final country in his marathon apostolic journey. It has been a busy week for the Holy Father as he completes a 12-day journey in Southeast Asia and Oceania, the longest of his pontificate. As is custom during his papal travels, Pope Francis made an effort to highlight Catholics on the peripheries with visits to some of the poorest and most remote parts of the region. Traditional drummers and dancers welcomed Pope Francis to Papua New Guinea last Friday. Peace was at the center of his message to the nation ripe with natural resources and diversity, but torn apart by tribal conflict. During a youth festival, Pope Francis told thousands of young people about the universal language of love and how it can bridge the gap in a land where more than 800 dialects are spoken. One of the highlights of his visit, a trip to the remote coastal village of Vanimo, where he brought food and supplies for residents. There, Pope Francis encouraged local Catholics to be missionaries in all that they do. A sight to behold in East Timor, where throngs of faithful joined Pope Francis for an open-air mass. An estimated 600,000 people attended. That's almost half the small nation's entire population. His other stops in the country included visits with clergy, young people, and local authorities. He also visited a home for children with disabilities, where he spoke to them and their caretakers one-on-one. On Wednesday, Pope Francis arrived in his final stop, Singapore. His visit included meetings with the president, prime minister, and civil authorities. On Thursday night, he celebrated Mass in the National Stadium with tens of thousands in attendance. The economic disparity between the gleaming modern Singapore and his other stops was obvious. The Pope praised Singapore for providing public housing, quality education, and healthcare to its people, But he urged leaders to look out for the poor and called for dignified conditions for its migrant workers who have helped to build the gleaming skyscrapers of one of the world's richest countries. Our EWTN News colleague Courtney Mars joins us from Singapore, where Pope Francis wrapped up his Southeast Asia travels. Courtney is a Rome correspondent for Catholic News Agency. Courtney, great to see you. There's a lot to catch up on from your whirlwind week with Pope Francis. There are stunning images from when our Holy Father arrived in Papua New Guinea of indigenous tribes welcoming him. Can you tell us more?
There was a great meeting of some of Papua New Guinea's 300 indigenous tribes in the capital city of Port Moresby. Many of the Catholics I spoke with traveled for hours to come to see Pope Francis, some from some of the most remote parts of the country, including the country's tropical rainforests and outlying islands. Papua New Guinea is a country that is renowned for its cultural, linguistic, and biodiversity, and it's home to more than 800 languages. But amid all of this diversity, Papua New Guinea is overwhelmingly Christian. 90% of the population in the country calls itself Christian. So you could really feel that enthusiasm with the Pope's visit.
Absolutely. And Courtney, a theme of Pope Francis's pontificate has been to go to the peripheries. And he did just that in Papua New Guinea. Where did Pope Francis go?
Pope Francis went to the remote coastal city of Vanimo. And it's a place that can only be, you can only get there from boat or airplane. Pope Francis traveled there with the help of the Royal Australian Air Force, who carried the Pope in a C-130 plane, along with toys, medicine, and humanitarian aid for the people there. Once the Pope arrived, he was welcomed by 20,000 people in one of the most remote parts of the country.
Incredible. And in East Timor, nearly half of the country's population showed up for the papal mass, an estimated 600,000 people. You were there, Courtney. What was that like?
The papal mass in East Timor was a spectacle to behold. The Tossi Tolu field was just a sea of yellow and white Vatican-themed umbrellas, which people used for protection from the hot tropical sun as they waited for hours for the Pope to arrive. I spoke with one family who told me that they arrived at the field at 4 a.m. for the papal mass that was scheduled to arrive at 4 p.m. Thankfully, they were in the front of the crowd.
It's so beautiful to see the faith so alive. And Courtney, about 97% of East Timor is Catholic, likely the most Catholic country in the world. What was our Holy Father's message to the people of East Timor?
That's right. In nearly every one of Pope Francis's speeches in East Timor, he praised the youthfulness of the country. East Timor is a country with one of the highest birth rates in the world. After it achieved its independence in 2002, the birth rate was an average of 7 births per woman. And this is something that Pope Francis commended. At the end of his massive mass in East Timor, Pope Francis told the crowd that the best thing about Timor is the smiles of its children.
That's incredible. And Pope Francis concluded this ambitious journey in Singapore, where you are right now. Tell us about the Singapore leg of the trip, Courtney.
Yeah, so for this final leg of the trip, Pope Francis flew from East Timor, which is one of the poorest countries in the region, to Singapore, which is an economic powerhouse and really an Asian financial hub. In fact, the GDP per capita here is higher than in the United States. And there really was kind of this jarring disparity when we landed from the country we came from to the country where we arrived. And I think that Pope Francis picked up on this too, because in his first speech here in Singapore, Pope Francis praised the country's efficient healthcare system and entrepreneurial spirit. But he also underlined again and again the importance of the dignity of the poor. And he also called on all Singaporeans to protect the dignity of the many migrant workers who help support this economy here in Singapore.
Courtney, you know, at the start of this trip, many commented on Pope Francis's age and his health. How did our Holy Father ultimately hold up throughout this trip? Could you see moments of frail health at all throughout the week?
That is something that I was watching for throughout the trip because it was the most ambitious and longest of his pontificate. But let me tell you, the 87-year-old Pope did not miss a beat. I mean, he gave every single one of his speeches, made every single one of his public appearances without any assistance reading the speeches, which is something he hasn't always been able to do, even in Rome when he's had some of his bouts of difficult health earlier this year. When I think about the length of this staggering journey, I think back to Pope Francis's very first stadium mass, which happened on the feast of St. Teresa of Calcutta, Mother Teresa. And in that mass, Pope Francis quoted this beautiful quote from Mother Teresa. He said, "If you have nothing left to give, give that nothing." And I imagine that that's been something that Pope Francis has carried with him through this long and difficult, but also beautiful journey here in Southeast Asia.
Oh, that's so powerful. You know, Courtney, just in our last moment together, you've been with Pope Francis with every step of this trip. What will you remember? What will you take away from this pontifical journey?
One line that also comes to mind that Pope Francis said is, "Let the islands rejoice." And that we've been visiting four island nations here in Asia, and there's been so much joy. I think just the joy and the faith and the enthusiasm of the people that I've encountered here is something that will stay in my heart forever.
Mm. Well, and you bring that joy to us. Thank you for your incredible reporting, and I hope you have a safe flight back to Rome as well. Courtney Mares, thank you.
Thank you, Catherine.
Pope Francis told reporters on Friday both U.S. presidential candidates are, quote, against life. The remarks came during Pope Francis's signature in-flight press conference from Singapore to Rome at the conclusion of his Southeast Asia papal visit. When asked what advice he would give to U.S. Catholic voters having to decide between a candidate who favors abortion and a candidate who wants to deport millions of migrants, the Holy Father said, quote, "Both of them are against life, both the one who throws out migrants and the one who kills children. Both are against life." Pope Francis said it's a sin to not protect the migrant and that, quote, "immigration is a right that is in sacred scripture, and it was in the Old Testament. The stranger, the orphan, and the widow, don't forget that." And in strong words condemning abortion, the Holy Father said, "To send away a child from the womb of the mother is an assassination because there is life. We must speak about these things clearly, but no buts." EWTN News senior Vatican analyst Francis Rocca shares more on the Holy Father's remarks.
Well, the Pope was asked how he would advise Catholic voters in the United States. He said people have to choose the lesser evil, but he wouldn't say what that lesser evil was. He said that everybody has to use his or own conscience in deciding. So that position underscores a longstanding point of tension between the Vatican under Pope Francis and the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, who have repeatedly said in their voter guide that opposition to abortion is the preeminent priority. But the Pope is saying, in effect, that abortion doesn't necessarily trump other issues.
You can find complete coverage of the Holy Father's apostolic journey and what he said in this latest in-flight press conference across the EWTN News coverage, including at CatholicNewsAgency.com and NCRegister.com. When we come back, it's off to Quito, Ecuador for highlights and analysis of the International Eucharistic Congress. And then you, our viewers, share your thoughts about us, the EWTN Global Catholic Network, and the legacy of what Mother Angelica built.
Thank you, EWTN. Thank you very much. You guys are an inspiration to all of us.
EWTN has been a great resource to help us learn about and grow in our Catholic faith, so thank you so much.
Porque esto es mi cuerpo que será entregado por ustedes.
The 53rd International Eucharistic Congress opened with Mass last Sunday in Quito, Ecuador. Archbishop Alfredo Jose Espinoza Mateus of the Archdiocese of Quito celebrated the Mass outdoors with some 25,000 faithful in attendance. During the Mass, hundreds of children received their first communion, a moment the Archbishop said will remain engraved in their hearts for life. The International Eucharistic Congress gathers Catholics from all over the world to reflect on the true presence of Jesus Christ in the Eucharist. This year, more than 40 countries sent delegations to the Congress to reflect on its theme, Fraternity to Heal the World. Like the National Eucharistic Congress the U.S. saw earlier this summer, this International Congress gives attendees an opportunity to listen to testimonies, encounter community, and, of course, spend plenty of time with Christ in the Blessed Sacrament. On Saturday, the Congress holds a Eucharistic procession in the historic center of Quito. This Congress coincides with the 150th anniversary of the consecration of Ecuador to the Sacred Heart of Jesus, the first country to ever do so. International Eucharistic Congresses have a long history in the Catholic Church. Reporter Colin Flynn explains.
The International Eucharistic Congress, known in short as the IEC, is a gathering of clergy, religious, and lay people coming together to celebrate and promote the Catholic Church's fundamental belief in the presence of Jesus Christ in the Eucharist. It began in 1881 in Lille, France, initiated by a laywoman named Marie-Martha Tamizier. At the time, she was worried about the decline of the Catholic Church in France following the French Revolution, and so, as a way of fostering devotion to the Eucharist and strengthening the global Catholic community, she established the first International Eucharistic Congress. She was supported by the Pope of the day, Pope Leo XIII. Typically held every 4 years or so, the IEC started to grow, gathering larger crowds of faithful, sometimes up to 1.5 million, to celebrate the importance and power of the Eucharist.
Catholics from all over the world are in the Brazilian capital.
Many countries, including the United States, subsequently set up and organized national Eucharistic congresses. Over the years, the IEC has grown into a significant event, hosted in various countries such as Ireland, the Philippines, South Korea, Kenya, and Australia. During the Congress, Catholics gather for masses, processions, and theological discussions, serving as a powerful expression of faith, unity, and the central role of the Eucharist in Catholic life. To date, there have been a total of 52 International Eucharistic Congresses, four of which have already been hosted in Latin America, in Argentina in 1934, Brazil in 1955, Colombia in 1968, and Mexico in 2004. Popes have often celebrated Mass at these events. For example, Pope Francis celebrated Mass at the IEC in Hungary in 2021. And now, this 53rd International Eucharistic Congress is bringing it back to South America, to Quito in Ecuador. Colm Flynn, EWTN News in Depth.
The EWTN Global Catholic Network has been broadcasting portions of the International Eucharistic Congress, providing coverage in both Spanish and in English. Joining us now, two members of our broadcast team, Dr. Matthew Bunsen, editorial director for EWTN News, and Father Thomas Petrie, president of the Dominican House of Studies in Washington, D.C. Gentlemen, great to see you, and you both have been doing tremendous work this week. The theme for this International Eucharistic Congress is Fraternity to Heal the World. How have you heard that theme play out throughout the week, and how is that theme connected to our Eucharistic Lord? Matthew, I'll go to you first.
Yeah, well, one of the things that became very apparent from day one was that they wanted to make very clear, before you can solve problems, you need to know about them. And so as the week began, we heard very searing testimony of the problems of the world, the wounds of the world. The subsequent days have focused on the solution to that, the prescription for that, which, of course, is the Eucharist. But that implies things like transfiguration in the Eucharist. And Father, I know you can talk more about that. As this week has also progressed, it's going going to be culminating with this Eucharistic procession. So the heart of this is the Eucharist. And that's a point that the Bishop Cousins was trying to make as well, that fraternity builds out of the Eucharist and it impels us toward fraternity.
Mm. Father, what are your thoughts on the theme?
The thing that's become really poignant about this Eucharistic Congress is something that goes back to a concern that even Pope Pius XII had with his encyclical Mediator Dei, which is that when we go to Mass, when we commune in the Eucharist, when we receive Holy Communion, it's not just a vertical relationship of me and God, which is, of course, primary, but we're also relating to each other. And so the Eucharist, the Mass, this fraternity, it's just as though saying when we participate fully and interiorly in the Holy Liturgy, in the Holy Mass, we should then take the graces we receive by being united to Christ into the world and then evangelize the world. And of course, in Pope Francis' pontificate, with a great emphasis on reaching the fringe, those on the fringe and those who are suffering.
Thank you for sharing that. Matthew, Pope Francis was largely expected to be in attendance, but as we've been reporting on this very program, he's been in Southeast Asia instead on his most ambitious papal trip yet. How significant is it that our Holy Father is not present in Quito for the International Eucharistic Congress, and has he sent a message in his place?
Yeah, well, it was noted, of course, that Pope Francis was not here for the opening Mass and would not be attending this Eucharistic Congress. It's not unheard of for popes not to attend Eucharistic Congresses around the world. Pope Francis made the decision that he was needed somewhere else, and that's Southeast Asia. And as we have seen the events there unfold, the spectacular trip by the Holy Father to that part of the world, and the legacy that I think he's building there, it makes sense that he chose not to be here. Mm-hmm. Now, that does not mean that Pope Francis has not felt here. He sent a video message that was played on the opening day of the Eucharistic Congress in which he talked about the Eucharist, as specifically talking about the courage that the Eucharist can give us and that we have to have for the Eucharist. He cited an example of a woman by the name of Angela Auch, who died in Auschwitz, and she was placed there, arrested there for her defense and love of the Blessed Sacrament. Mm-hmm. The Holy Father also sent a representative, a papal legate, similar to the one at the National Eucharistic Congress. In this case, it's Cardinal Baltimore Porras, who is the emeritus bishop of Caracas, Venezuela. So he's here at Pope Francis' behest. There's also been a strong Roman Vatican presence, including Cardinal Gambetti, Mauro Gambetti, the Archpriest of St. Peter's, who is one of the keynote speakers here. So there is very much a Roman presence here, and Francis has felt.
Mm. Father, this event coincides with a special anniversary in Ecuador, 150 years of the consecration of Ecuador to the Sacred Heart of Jesus. How significant is that, and how is it being among the faithful in Ecuador? Are you able to see the fruit of that consecration?
Well, the 150th anniversary of the consecration of Ecuador to the Sacred Heart is clearly a big part of the Eucharistic Congress. It's why Ecuador was chosen for this International Eucharistic Congress. Ecuador was the first country in history to be consecrated to the Sacred Heart. And remember, the Sacred Heart is that beautiful image of the love of Christ's divinity coming through his humanity, sacrificed on the cross for us. The Ecuadorians have a strong devotion to the Sacred Heart, and I think one of the common themes that we've experienced every single day while being here, and something all of our guests on this set have also noted, is the tremendous warmth and hospitality that the Ecuadorian people have given to us. Even walking on the streets among Ecuadorians who aren't coming to this International Eucharistic Congress, I can't tell you how many times I've been stopped just to be asked for a priestly blessing. Mm-hmm. It's been a wonderful week and a wonderful experience. Yeah.
Matthew, for many of our U.S. viewers, the recent National Eucharistic Congress in Indianapolis is still fresh in our minds. Can you speak about the relationship between the International Eucharistic Congress and the 10th National one we recently celebrated stateside?
Yeah, one of the most well-received of the speakers here this week has been Bishop Andrew Cousins, who is one of the brainchilds of one of the leaders of the National Eucharistic Congress in the United States. And he spoke directly about the close connection that exists between a National Eucharistic Congress and an international one. Obviously, the U.S. one, the national one, was focused on evangelizing and reviving the love and worship of the Eucharist on the United States front, North America. What he brought here was the same message of hope, of the need for a revival, the need for us to focus on the Eucharist. And this International Eucharistic Congress is going to try to accomplish globally what was accomplished nationally for us in the U.S., and that is that the participants, the delegates, will go home, their bishops especially, looking to sort of recreate the spirit here, but also the spirit of the National Eucharistic Congress. So each one feeds the other, and I think that's part of the legacy of International Eucharistic Congresses around the world.
Absolutely. Father, we have just over 1 minute left, but I'm thinking about these recent Eucharistic events in the life of the church, the upcoming canonization of young Blessed Carlo Acutis, who himself had such a devotion to the Eucharist. Can you just share your reflections? Is the Holy Spirit drawing the faithful closer to our Eucharistic Lord in this moment in the church?
I think that was another common point of agreement between us and all of our guests this week, that it does seem that the Holy Spirit is doing something to revive and renew devotion to the Blessed Sacrament. You're right, Blessed Carlo Acutis, you know, the National Eucharistic Congress. We see so many young people here. Many bishops that we've spoken to have noted how Eucharistic adoration sort of declined not long after the Second Vatican Council and how it is, in fact, making its return. We've had several speakers speak, say that just sitting in front of the Blessed Sacrament, whether it's in the tabernacle or in a monstrance, being in silence, this is what helps us to come to know Jesus Christ. He will speak to you, and he will empower you to do his will and have a greater love, not only of the Blessed Sacrament, but the sacrament of confession and attending Mass. I think it's an exciting time. I think everyone has agreed there's something going on, and it's all very good.
It's all very good. Well, Matthew and Father, thank you for your great work this week, and thank you for your time today. News headlines are next in the Week in Review. Economic news, as well as abortion developments at the state level, top the Week in Review. Both issues promise to be top of mind for voters this November. First, a look at pocketbook issues impacting the wallets of all Americans, starting with inflation. Prices are cooling. On Wednesday, the Bureau of Labor Statistics pegged the 12-month inflation rate at 2.5%, the lowest level in 3 years since February 2021. The drop was mostly due to falling energy prices. But while many retail prices may be leveling off, one expense area remains stubbornly high. Housing prices continue to rise for both homeowners and renters. New data released on Thursday from the Census Bureau shows renters paid more than 30% of their income on housing costs. And these state abortion law developments, a North Dakota judge on Thursday struck down the state's pro-life law, claiming the state constitution creates a so-called right to abortion before a baby is viable or can live on its own outside of the mother's womb, which is around 22 weeks. The judge's order would legalize abortion in the state, but there are currently no abortion facilities operating in North Dakota. Republican officials are expected to appeal. After a brief legal shuffle, Missouri Supreme Court ruled this week a pro-abortion ballot measure will remain on the state's ballot in November. The decision was made just hours before the first absentee ballots were printed. The High Court heard arguments regarding the ballot amendment on Tuesday morning, just days after a lower court judge ruled the measure did not meet legal requirements for the ballot. The ballot measure would guarantee what's called a right to abortion in the state constitution and allow the procedure up to viability. Pro-life advocates who brought on the lawsuit argued the measure was misleading to voters because it did not specify which laws it would repeal. Mary Catherine Martin, senior counsel at the Thomas More Society, argued the case in front of the court. She calls the decision devastating.
It's good to guard your heart in this business, and a lot of things don't go the right way. But in this case, the law was exceptionally clear. That is, in fact, how we won in the trial court. And it's hard to accept the effort and the lengths that even judges will go to cater to the forces behind an amendment like this.
Rachel Sweet, the campaign manager for Missourians for Constitutional Freedom, the group behind the measure, praised the ruling, calling it a victory for both direct democracy and reproductive freedom in Missouri, and a validation of the more than 380,000 Missourians who signed the petition. Missouri is just one of 10 states with pro-abortion measures on the ballot this November, including the swing states of Florida and Arizona. EWTN News will continue to provide coverage on abortion ballot initiatives through Election Day in November on both EWTN News In Depth and EWTN Pro-Life Weekly. An update to the very sad news about hostages held in Gaza. The Israeli military released footage this week from a tunnel in Gaza where it says Hamas murdered 6 hostages late last month, including Israeli-American Hirsch Goldberg Polin. The tunnel, about 70 feet underground, had no bathroom and poor ventilation. It is not known how long the hostages and at least 2 militants stayed there, but it is believed to be more than a few days. The tunnel was too low to stand upright in. A bucket appeared to be the makeshift toilet. There were mattresses and some food, mainly energy bars and tuna fish. There were also bloodstains on the floor where the 6 hostages were shot and killed at point-blank range. The Israelis say 101 hostages from the Hamas attack on October 7th remain unaccounted for, though at least 35 are believed to already be dead. The United States is pushing back against Israel after Israeli soldiers in the West Bank fatally shot a Turkish-American activist from Seattle, Washington. 26-year-old Aysenor Ezi Egi was shot in the head after attending a weekly protest against an Israeli settlement near a Palestinian village. The shooting was reportedly unprovoked a full 20 minutes after the protesters had left the demonstration area. The Western-backed Palestinian Authority held a funeral procession for Egi on Monday, her body draped in a Palestinian flag. Dozens of mourners attended. The White House says it is deeply disturbed by her killing. Commenting about the incident, Secretary of State Antony Blinken said no one should be shot and killed for attending a protest.
We've seen reports of excessive force by Israeli security forces against Palestinians. And now we have the second American citizen killed at the hands of Israeli security forces. It's not acceptable. It has to change.
Blinken spoke in London during meetings with British Foreign Secretary David Lammy. The two announced their cooperation in supporting Ukraine with an immediate joint U.S.-UK visit to Kiev. Later in the week, the two diplomats traveled to Ukraine to visit President Volodymyr Zelensky at a crucial point in Ukraine's standoff with Russia. They reiterated firm support for Ukraine and criticized Iran's reported shipment of ballistic missiles to Russia. One of our country's most prominent Catholic universities officially has a new president. After an inauguration mass on Friday at the Basilica of the Sacred Heart, Father Robert Dowd was inaugurated as the 18th president of the University of Notre Dame. Later that afternoon, at a convocation and investiture ceremony, Dowd delivered his inaugural address and received the blessing of Presidents Emeriti. A 1987 graduate of Notre Dame, Father Dowd has been a faculty member in its political science department, specializing in international religious studies. A priest of the Congregation of Holy Cross, he is just the 4th person to serve as president of the University of Notre Dame in the past 70 years. After spending months out of the public eye, Catherine, Princess of Wales, has finished chemotherapy. She announced the health update in a new video from Kensington Palace.
As the summer comes to an end, I cannot tell you what a relief it is to have finally completed my chemotherapy treatment.
The new video shows Princess Kate with her husband, Prince William, and their 3 children. Her disappearance from the public eye in December caused a media frenzy. She later shared that she had cancer, though did not reveal what kind or how advanced it was. With her chemo complete, Kate hopes to return to a work schedule and make more public engagements as she is able. She is the 2nd high-ranking member of the royal family to announce a cancer diagnosis after King Charles announced his in February. The EWTN family is front and center when we return.
Welcome. I'm so happy that you are here with us and that you've chosen to be a part of this great family celebration.
We will take you to last weekend's EWTN family celebration in Canada next.
I think the church in Canada is doing well. It is filled with lots of people who love the Lord Jesus and are following him. And it's a diverse church in terms of demographics, in terms of the communities they're originally from, and the gifts that they bring to the larger population of the Canadian scene.
The recently appointed shepherd of the largest archdiocese in Canada shares what makes the Northern Nations Catholic Church so special. Catholics make up Canada's largest religious denomination and can be found throughout the vast country. And the church reflects the rich diversity of Canada's people, from Indigenous communities and French Canadians to immigrants from all over the world. And Canada is where EWTN chose to host its annual EWTN Family Celebration this past weekend. Every year, we go to a different city to invite you, the viewer, to pray, join in fellowship, and to meet some of your favorite EWTN personalities. Reporter Roselle Regis tells us about this year's event.
The Eternal Word Television Network Family Celebration, a day where our EWTN family meets your family.
Calling it a family celebration, like really is true. Like, it's so nourishing. Like, you really do feel like they're part of your spiritual fathers and your guides. And I just met Father Mitch just now and just shook his hand.
Beginning of EWTN, Foundress Mother Angelica has always addressed the audience as family.
Well, we got so many wonderful family here, and they're from everywhere.
And decades later, EWTN continues her legacy by hosting an annual EWTN Family Celebration. Since 2005, EWTN hosts the event in a different city to meet as many people as possible.
I have come to know EWTN way back when I was still living in the Philippines. When my husband saw the flyer about they're coming to Toronto, my husband said, come, let's go.
I was really excited to find out that you guys were coming to Canada. I've been listening for a number of years on the radio.
This year, this celebration of faith and fellowship was held in Toronto, Canada. During EWTN's family celebration, people were able to meet with EWTN personalities and clergy.
I'm here today because I love EWTN and wanted to show some support and meet some of the faces that I always get to see on TV.
And be blessed with a day of prayer and faith-enriching talks featuring speakers Father Chris Aylar, Jeanette Williams, and Father Raymond D'Souza.
I got to know all the priests. It's like my second family.
The theme for this year was Stand Firm in the Faith.
The only way you're going to maintain joy is if you hold on to that hope. There's something greater than what we are facing here today.
We will change the world. God in us will change the world.
After the speeches, EWTN personalities took the stage for Family Talk, where President of EWTN News, Monse Alvarado, spoke about Mother Angelica and what Mother means to her.
I think any young woman who looks at the church and loves the Blessed Mother encounters Mother Angelica and thinks, wow, what an embodiment of the feminine genius.
EWTN CEO Michael Warsaw also shared memories of Mother Angelica and her vision for the network.
What we need to do is to remain strong, remain firm in our faith. That was why Mother Angelica founded EWTN all those many years ago, was to give hope in dark times, to encourage people in their faith, to encourage people to live an authentic Catholic life.
After Family Talk was Holy Mass with Archbishop Emeritus Cardinal Thomas Collins, where he reminded attendees that we are missionaries of Christ.
We will be what we're meant to be, and we can evangelize this world. It took 12 apostles. I mean, we can, there, with Pentecostal fire, that's our mission.
Here's what they loved most about EWTN's family celebration.
I love EWTN because I just love the kids section. There's lots of varieties and it's very interesting to watch.
Father Chris is just such an inspiration. Really helped me just grow my knowledge of the faith.
To me, EWTN is a friend.
somebody that journeys with you, and I think that's what we all need. Catholics need that.
This outrageous EWTN News in Depth.
If you would like to see more of the 2024 EWTN Family Celebration, it is available on EWTN On Demand. Plus, a broadcast of highlights from the Toronto event will air Saturday, September 21st. Check EWTN's program guide for details. And that does it for this edition of EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hedro. We hope to see you again, our EWTN family, same time next week for more news and reports important to your Catholic life. Until then, God bless.